For more episodes just like this one on a weekly basis, subscribe to RLRCPSolvers.com. You will not regret it.
Is it Reza loves Robbie or Robbie loves Reza? It's the best palindrome, you will be so impressed. Oh, it's the mathematician and the magician laying out the art of deduction. It's RLR.
Welcome back, clinical problem solvers.
I can't woo when there's a third person in the room.
Why can't you?
I don't know. I can't do it. I'm just so enamored by our guests.
Can I do it?
Woo!
What's weird, before we introduce our guest, is that Robbie and I never record in the same room. And many times people complain about Robbie's audio. And now we have to make sure we actually face the microphone. This is quite weird.
Prof. Rez is in San Francisco, lovely people. He reminded both of us that he called all of you fans and was rapidly corrected by me this weekend.
There was a few moments in Sonoma
where
both of our ignorance was at full display in front of our partners.
Indeed.
And each time it happened, we were hoping that we were recording for the amusement of our fans.
The best one, Prof. Red, I think, was when we were trying to turn the grill off. took a combined team effort of a PGY 30 to conclusively turn off a grill. And most of us were like, we should probably get one of our partners
to make sure.
Oh, my gosh, Prof. Red.
I am really excited for today because we have a special guest. A special, special guest who we can't even reveal their actual identity because they are in the process of releasing a book titled A Dangerous Diagnosis, which features a diagnostician that is almost like Robbie. Imagine you wrote a book about Robbie. Every aspect of this book, particularly the diagnosis, is like Robbie. And the author of this book is Shantanu Rai, and that's who we have. And I think we might be one of the first people lucky enough to interview this author. And I'm just going to say this before we – Robbie knows I talk a lot, and I'm talking a lot right now.
Yeah, no, this is very balanced.
But let me just say this. The beginning of this book starts with a patient – unfortunately taking 3 Viagra tablets, and then Dr. Sanjay Patel, the protagonist, having to come and save the day. And this patient is on a yacht surrounded by supermodels. So basically living my dream life, but Robbie being Sanjay Patel, me being all the other stuff of that life. Welcome to the RLR podcast.
That's just another day at the VA, basically. Plus the supermodels.
How are you, Shantanu Rai?
I am doing great. So excited to be on the show. Huge fan. And just so excited to be talking about this with you guys.
We're going to ask you a few questions. I'll kick it off and then Robbie will ask you a question.
Okay.
Tell us, like, what inspired you to write this book? Because it's a huge undertaking.
The key is that you don't know how big of it. It's like going to medical school. You don't realize how long it is, right? the inspiration kind of came in waves because it takes a lot of time. You know, like I'm a practicing doc, like primary care doc in the safety net. And I think it started, you know, the first inspiration was kind of like, you know, I had this flash of, like, I think doctors are heroes, you know? Like, I like to say, like, not all doctors, you know, not all heroes wear capes, you know? And so I had this flash of this idea of like, hey, there's this doctor. He's like flying around the world. He's like saving lives. He's, you know, flying on his private jet. He's getting paid with like, you know, Gucci bags full of cash. Right. And so like that was like on one level is this inspiration of, hey, like, you know, a lot of us, we go into medicine, you know, we decide when we're 18, 22, some of us 25, some of us decide at 10. Right. But it's like we didn't have our 20s. We didn't have our 30s in many respects. And so I was sort of like, man, could I write a novel? Like, could I try my hand on this? You know? So that was like part of it was just a challenge. That was part of the inspiration was like, yeah, like maybe this is a part of me that I never got to learn about because I was so busy, you know, learning about the Krebs cycle. And then as I started writing it, what I realized was, so the main character, like you said, so he's this concierge doctor for like oligarchs and billionaires. Like, so he's like concierge medicine to like the max, right? So at some point in the book, we talk about how he gets paid $100,000 a year per patient, right? So he's like this extreme. But then as I started writing, I started being like, well, why is he doing that? Because part of his backstory is he's a lot like all of us, right? Like, he went to medicine for the right reasons. He actually, was an immigrant and wanted to take care of like uninsured patients like his family. So I started thinking, like, man, why did this guy go from, like a doctor like all of us to like sort of this kind of sleazy seeming character at the beginning, right? Who's kind of, doing Botox injections on a yacht. And as I started thinking about that story, I started stumbling upon kind of the story of moral injury. Like the story of, all of us at some point in our careers or multiple points of our careers, we get to the point where we're like, man, what are we doing here? Right? Like, we're making a bunch of money for the hospital, like we have to deal with these insurance companies, like the time, like I have 10 minutes to see the patient. I got to somehow come up with a diagnosis and treat them. But it's just like, then I see them back 3 months later and they're dealing with the same issues because I didn't have enough time to address them. And so I started realizing, wow, this is every doctor's story. Now, it's obviously fiction, so he took it to an extreme, but we all have this moment where we're like dealing with the moral injury or dealing with the like, wow, this is what medicine is. And he, of course, decides to exit stage left and become this like this doctor to supermodels. But I think the story, his journey, is a journey that all of us. And so I started realizing, like, wow, if I can tell this story, maybe I can, it'll resonate with doctors. And you'll like You'll, I won't want to give it away, but like he ends up coming up with an alternative to just like running away and being this doctor on yachts. But like that journey was something I really wanted to write about, and I wanted to, and that sort of inspired me to keep going.
I can feel how much this book has impacted you, just sort of like your own journey in medicine. I'm really curious. I think the average person listening to this specific podcast is somebody who absolutely loves medicine. So what do you anticipate their lives to be different after they read your book, and what was it for you?
Oh, wow. I love that question. I really love that question. I hope, well, first and foremost, I hope it's cathartic. It was for me. I think, if you think about, and it's funny because now so many of us are watching The Pit, right? And it's like, I don't know about you guys, but when I'm watching The Pit, I'm actually remembering patients that I forgot. Like, I totally forgot taking care of like pretty much the exact same patient. And I think we go through training so fast. There's so much going on that I hope that reading the book for people on some levels of catharsis, I hope it helps them remember those stories, remember those patients, and actually start to process it more. I don't think we really process everything we see. So I think that's one. I think two, I hope they feel proud. Like I said about not every, hero wears a cape. I really hope, like, it's pretty cool. Like we like I I have, so many friends who are doctors, and I'm always like, man, you saved a life. And they're like, oh no, I just kind of, did my job. Like, I just think we're so used to it, and we're all so humble. Like, hopefully people kind of come off of it feeling proud. And then I think the last is inspired. Like, I very clearly at the end, there's a direction that I'm like the protagonist is pushing himself, and I as the author am pushing the reader. And I hope it inspires people to push that direction.
Well, listen, I love that answer, Shantanu Rai. And I have to say, I was lucky enough to read this book, and I couldn't put it down. And I'm just putting that out there in the world that I highly, highly recommend anyone who loves diagnosis, and especially anyone who likes a thriller and couldn't put down House of God, this book is for you. It's like, because I'm not one dimensional in terms of diagnosis. I like the other stuff. What are you looking at me for? And I, when I was reading it, I was like, why can't I exit left and be on the yacht? So I just want to congratulate you on writing such a good book. We're going to have a link to the book on the website. And for our colleagues in the whole podcast field, from Matt Watto to others, highly encourage you guys collaborate with Shantanu Rai. Get in touch with us. We'll let you know how to get in touch with him. And today we have something very fun. Robbie, explain what we plan to do today.
Well, what better way to introduce you to the deep depths of this book than Dr. The author himself, Dr. Rai, presenting a case from the book itself. And we hear that we have a couple of teasers about it, that there's a massive diagnostic challenge and a very interesting find. Odds are we won't get it, but we'll certainly have fun trying. So yeah, we get to go through a case in real life from this book, and very excited to go on that journey with you all.
And the challenge is, RRR as good as Sanjay Patel, who is the protagonist in the book? We'll find out. Stay tuned and we'll find out.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Prof Rez just nudged me to tackle the first aliquot, which okay, Prof Rez, I guess that means you have to tackle the last one, right? Mic to Shantanu.
Right, you ready for this?
Yeah, let's do it.
All right, so this is a patient that I actually saw when I was a med student,
Crazy.
and it stuck with me for years. And then I ended up putting the actual
Can I
patient
ask
in the
you real quick,
book.
not to interrupt? Did writing the book spark the memory? Like, had you forgotten about this patient?
This one, no.
Okay,
This
all
one, no.
right.
This is one I actually think about, I'd say,
Yeah.
on a monthly basis.
Wow.
Yeah. Yeah.
Oh God, I
So,
regret asking that question now.
this is a 26-year-old Marine,
Ooh.
female Marine stationed in Southeast Asia. When she started having daily spiking fevers. And I met her, and the protagonist meets her 4 months into her journey. So she's been having these spiking fevers every single month, or sorry, every single day for 4 months. And she's seen, at the point that I met her, at the point that the character met her, she's already seen like 100 doctors. So she was stationed in Southeast Asia. She ended up going to Okinawa, where we have a big base, right? Then she ended up going to Germany, then to Walter Reed. So she was getting bounced around. No one could figure out what was going on. Previously healthy, 26-year-old Marine.
I mean, yeah, that's a geez. That sounds really tough, both in terms of getting to the bottom of it from a diagnostic perspective, but also somebody to go through. I think Prof. Rice teaches this so well. Whenever somebody is inflamed and has a fever, it really is a question of where is it coming from? What is the origin of the inflammation? And there is a strong presumption that the nature of the inflammation is infectious once we figure out the origin of it. And I think odds are if somebody just has a fever that lasts for 4 months, there's a little bit of a paradox that's set up. And that paradox is that the whole point of a fever is to warn you that there's disaster coming, right? That you are going to suffer some consequences. And the longer the fever ensues without an obvious consequence to that, you start to wonder, well, is the actual immune system the problem? And so I think that a deep dive into a patient's chart when you're inheriting such complexity in the first 4 months is to ask yourself, okay, I know she's inflamed. Let's inventory all the consequences. And if you find them, then you know where the fever is coming from, and you start to change your problem representation into inflammatory blank, inflammatory liver disease, inflammatory kidney disease, inflammatory lung disease, and you focus much more on the consequence rather than the inflammation. But many of these cases, when the fever goes unexplained for 4 months, you're left with nothing. And you're like, hey, this is just a fever. And so you start to wonder, well, what's going on with the fire alarm? Because there's definitely no fire. And I think that's the branch point that I'm trying to figure out is what have been the consequences of this issue? And if the issue has been inconsequential, that becomes a really interesting riddle. Any reflections on that, Prof. Red?
Okay,
Prof.
so
Rez is
when you
nodding.
no,
I
I
couldn't
love
tell. I
it.
couldn't tell. He was like, I was average or okay.
No, it's no, I just love the I love kind of the way you're waxing about it. I think that's really cool. It's almost poetic. So just a little bit more about the fever. So they are like spiking high grade fevers, with sort of, she sort of wakes up with like a night sweat, shaking bones. She's lost a lot of weight during this period, but in part because she's also at this point kind of going through, like a mood disorder as well. I mean, she's kind of beginning to lose hope. Like, will she be able to, will anyone ever get to the bottom of this? She initially, when she had the presentation, they did a chest X-ray, right? They did, blood cultures. They tested her for a bunch of different things that were endemic to where she was stationed. Everything came back normal. She did have an elevated white count at one point, but not at the time that Sanjay was seeing her. And she also had been on multiple courses of empiric antibiotics. So for like a range of different things over the course of her illness, all PO. But at the time that he was seeing her, she had been off of antibiotics for a solid month and still having these fevers.
Yeah, I first of all, I just have to say, like, the way you're presenting this is a testament to the fact that you're an author.
Yeah.
Like, it's just the story you're telling. I'm like right there at the edge of my seat. And I think one, the mistake would be to judge any of the prior doctors or providers for giving this patient antibiotics, because many times patients will have a fever. And many times they will get antibiotics, and many times they will get better. In fact, not even giving antibiotics, a lot of times people's fevers will resolve. I did want to, before we talk a little bit about like what the next steps would be for this patient, I wanted to talk a little bit about pathophysiology because I find that most fascinating. And so why do people actually have night sweats? And where does fever actually originate from? I'm not sure if Sanjay Patel knows the answer to that, but Dr. Reza Mamesh and Robbie Vijaya do. You see, what Robbie did was he took fever, he translated that into inflammation. And that inflammation becomes the problem we're trying to solve. But when you say inflammation, you can say that is mediated by cytokines. And when you get cytokines, you raise the temperature set point in the hypothalamus. So now the body is trying to reach a higher temperature. And that's why you have chills, to increase the metabolic rate, to increase energy production, and to increase the temperature. So why do night sweats happen? Well, the cytokines aren't constantly elevated. They come and they go. And so when they wane, the temperature set point comes down, the body is overheated because the temperature set point is down. And the way to dissipate this heat is through sweats. And that's why night sweats happen. Now, Robbie was saying, where did this inflammation originate? And the fact that we're not getting signal to any specific organ, both based on symptoms and preliminary lab results, we now have to create a schema. And what we use at clinical problem solvers is really three, four primary categories. We call it the I made mnemonic, Shantanu, and the I is capitalized. It's infection, cancer, autoimmune, drugs, DVT, and endocrinopathies. The longer the fever lingers, the less likely it's a common viral or bacterial etiology. And all of a sudden, you start thinking about atypical infections. But I think the mistake you would make here is to be like Southeast Asia, this must be something atypical, like melioidosis, the cousin of tuberculosis. That would be a mistake. Malignancy and autoimmune come to surface, and we have to remind ourselves this is a 26-year-old patient, a young patient. So you can start speculating if this is malignancy, and Robbie taught me this. Liquid cancers are much more likely to cause fever. And a young person is at risk of lymphoma. And you might say, well, can lymphoma go undetected on chest X-ray? Of course it can. And there are different forms of lymphoma, like intravascular lymphoma, that the diagnosis can be very, very tricky. And I'm not going to speak too much more, but to say this. So if we're worried about atypical infections, if we're worried about cancers, liquid cancers, if we're worried about autoimmune diseases, where do we go next? And I think knowing that you work in a safety care setting, the question becomes, what tools do we have at our disposal to make progress? And something that we learned from Gurpreet is that really you can't call this a fever of unknown origin until you have cross-sectional imaging of the chest, abdomen, and pelvis.
Interesting.
So I think what I would do next, in addition to like reviewing all the regular labs, is get that cross-sectional imaging. The ESR and CRP aren't that helpful, but I would be interested. The ferritin isn't that helpful, but I would be interested. But I think if that cross-sectional imaging is negative, then all of a sudden I'm asking myself, well, maybe it's not infection per se, and maybe it's not cancer per se. But are we dealing with some kind of endocrinopathy or autoimmune process. Robbie, would you, what else would you add to your initial workup at this stage? Like, or like if you had to do one test, would it be the cross-sectional imaging of the chest?
Prof, I feel like you'd hit the nail on the head. I think weight loss is cracked 95% of the time by imaging, 5% of the time by an
Interesting.
HIV test and a TSH. And if it's not imaging positive or TSH slash HIV positive, it's all about dietary history. And I think it's interesting to see if her mood will play into the case. So yeah, I think for me, I'm getting all everything you mentioned, an HIV, a TSH, and odds are that those will be diagnostic in most normal cases. And if
I
not, then I
love
think
this.
it's
I'm
all
learning
about
so much. I
self-awareness.
love this. So let me hit some of that. So pan
Yeah.
imaging was negative. Pan imaging was negative.
Okay. Oh.
Chest, abdomen, and
This
pelvis.
is so easy now.
But let me give you some of the labs you asked for. So,
Yeah.
and I'm just going to give a whole bunch of them. So hemoglobin was 11.3, MCV was 85, white count was normal 11,000, ESR was 94, CRP was 89, ferritin 13,000, AST 100, ALT 39, albumin 3.9, LDH 872, ANA was 1 to 320. Double-stranded DNA was negative, rheumatoid factor negative, anti-CCP negative, and all the cultures are negative.
Crazy. Wow. Can I ask you mentioned the CBC, but I think it slipped my mind. Oh, her white cells were normal, you said? I know
They
you mentioned
were
they were normal.
10-5.
10-5. Yeah, I think that these findings are dramatic. It's and presumably by pan imaging we mean CT chest, abdomen, pelvis. Is that
Yes,
right?
that's right.
Yeah, I mean this is a fascinating space because you ask yourself how many cases that we take care of where patients have a sinister cause of weight loss that is imaging negative. It's very, very few. And so I think whenever you're surprised by a lab result that doesn't show lymphadenopathy, serositis, tumors, you really have to ask yourself what are the performance characteristics of that test? And I think the first thing I'd be asking myself is this true image negative or not because of just how unusual it is. And I think the patient's BMI is key here. Because if you remember the way we diagnose things on imaging is we rely on fat stranding. And if she's cachectic and frail from this process, there's much less fat in the belly and therefore much lower diagnostic yield. So yeah, I'm very struck by that. But I think there's a lot of really fascinating labs that I'll summarize and then maybe see what Prof Rez thinks. So the LDH is in the 800s. The ferritin is in over 10,000. There was some hepatocellular liver injury with sparing of the kidney function. So I think there are consequences to this process, and I think those consequences are probably the path that we will follow to some clarity. But what are you thinking?
I love that. And Shantanu, it was the AST was higher than the ALT, is that correct?
Correct.
100 was
100.
AST in it. The only because the one lab that really grabbed my attention and was unexpected was the LDH. Because you said the LDH was 876, correct? So that's an elevated LDH. You know, there's many labs in medicine when someone's inflamed that don't really add much value in terms of the diagnostic journey. But I feel once the LDH goes north of 500, it must be explained by the final diagnosis. And you may ask the question, so why does the LDH go up? Robbie has this beautiful like pyramid of LDH where you start at the top, and the top of the pyramid is hemolysis. And that's why I was asking about the AST to ALT, because we know that AST and ALT are not liver-specific enzymes. And particularly when you have this ratio, it raises the question, could there be a background of hemolysis? And that's explaining the LDH. So even though that's unlikely, I would still send the hemolytic workup, including, you know, a haptoglobin, a peripheral blood smear, just to make sure that I'm not dealing with hemolysis. And then once I make sure I'm not dealing with hemolysis, then the next question becomes, is an organ being infarcted? In fact, like if someone has a PE with an infarct, they used to send LDHs to make that or to be worried about that diagnostic consideration. So I'd be curious to know, is it, but Nothing you presented so far suggests that a tissue is being infarcted. So this really raises my concern for lymphoma. But then you might say, well, Reza, the platelet count is normal and the patient has no lymphadenopathy. They got pan scanned. So if it were lymphoma, it would be more of a trickier lymphoma, like an intravascular lymphoma, which we had a case in Baltimore where the hematology oncology chief resident was sitting there, and after a year, she made the diagnosis with random skin biopsies. And I said, "How did you know to do random skin biopsies?" She's like, "Of course, it's like, what else could it be? It's intra." I was like, well, "What is intravascular lymphoma? You're saying what else?" I'm like, "What is that diagnostic entity?" And then, they used to teach us, Shantanu, that when the ferritin is that high, it really limits the differential diagnosis to a few things like adult onset cell disease, HLH, hemochromatosis, histoplasmosis. But Andrew Olson published a paper saying that anything that causes inflammation can cause a ferritin to go above 13,000. So how does that affect my practice? Is I always ask, can it be one of those things like an HLH from an underlying lymphoma? Could it be adult onset cells? I think less likely. We don't have the leukocytosis and we don't have the salmon-colored rash. That's a diagnosis of exclusion. So I'm very curious, actually, Robbie, from your perspective, like where do you go next? I think an HIV test is really important. But where would you go next? I'm like struggling with that, to
Dude,
be honest.
my overly.
And let me just say something here. So I'm gonna amp up the as an author, the drama here. So
Yes.
at this point, so this is all chart biopsying.
Yeah.
Sanjay has not yet seen the patient, so
Oh, I
now he's
can't
about to
wait.
go in. He gets a chance to ask the patient himself what's been going on and take a physical. So as you're walking into the room,
Yeah.
right? So let's assume hemolysis labs came back negative, HIV's negative, but you're now walking into the room. You get a chance to talk to the patient, and he. I don't want to, put pressure on you. He figures it out with the history and physical at this
Oh,
point.
I think R squared is less than Dr. Patel's, the equation I'm coming up with.
But you guys are getting warm, let me tell you that.
Yeah,
So,
all I will share with everybody is probably an overly simplistic fundamental model of weight loss, which is weight loss is all about finding the structural cause, imaging positive disease. There are very, very few causes of substances that induce weight loss. So, truthfully, all of medicine is there a structural issue or is it a substance? Because if you can't see it, then it's probably a molecule. That's really, it all comes down to that. So, when I'm ch chatting with her, because we haven't been able to see anything with high quality tests, I'm trying to figure out, is there a substance involved? And substances can come from the world that induce weight loss, but the body can make them too. And so I would probably authentically, if I'm walking into a room like this, I would be so intrigued that I think the point that you're making as a doctor is so important. You have to let the room hit you. Is she cachectic? Is she tremulous? Is she sweating? Is there a hidden sarcoma in a place that nobody has looked, or a melanotic lesion nobody has looked? So yeah, I think history and physical is key for this patient because a deeper look with CAT scans hasn't found a structural issue. So is there a structural hit issue hidden somewhere, or is it actually a substance?
Yeah, and I can just see her so vividly in my head. So let me tell you what it looked like when I walked in the room and I got a chance to meet her when I was in med school.
This is
So
so cool.
yeah, so she was like a I'd say she was like a thin, but pretty healthy looking, 26-year-old. No cachexia, very tearful at times explaining her story. But she looked well, like so well that, there was a little thought in my mind of like, okay, she's having these nightly fevers. Like, has anyone ever seen her have these fevers? I mean, that's how well she looked,
Right.
but on the thinner side.
Was she eating?
Excuse me?
Was she eating? Like, was there a breakfast tray or?
Yeah, not when I saw her. Not when
Okay.
I saw her. But she looked like healthy. Like, she looked fit, right? I mean, as a Marine. I mean, I think she had a lot of life disruption, but I think, and she was going through, it emotionally as well. But I think, she seemed like she could kick my ass, basically. She was lean, but lean but thin
Great.
is what I'd say. And yeah, on exam, I mean, yeah, we looked head to toe. I mean, I think the one thing that we noticed was kind of around her joints, multiple joints, was a little bit like very, very mildly tender. Symmetrically across both her larger and smaller joints. But otherwise, we kind of looked, everywhere and couldn't see anything that jumped out at us.
Yeah, I'll be honest. I'm glad that there's physicians like Dr. Sanjay Patel out there. I because okay, here's where I'm just going to be authentic and I'm going to ask for Robbie's assistance. Like I heard the ANA of 1 to 320, but I you can use an ANA that's negative to pretty much rule out lupus. And we actually have a rheumatologist here in the room, so I have to be careful, which is Robbie's wife. I want to make sure she's not going to run and smack me in the face for making that comment about the ANA. But a positive test is not specific. And like I'm still trying to frame this problem as subacute to chronic, nightly inflammatory episodes with a high LDH, no lymphadenopathy, and I just can't like it's hard for and it seems like it's the LDH may not be related because you're telling us that this diagnosis is made at the bedside by just history alone. But if I'm being real and honest, like I use that LDH and then you combine it with nightly fevers, it's just like, and I understand the platelets are not down, but it makes me run towards like a lymphoma until proven otherwise. And I'm just trying to think like what substance or dietary thing can cause a rise in LDH. And I just can't. And look, if the LDH was like 300, I wouldn't be making this much noise about it. But 800 is telling me that there is cell turnover. And so maybe when we learn the final diagnosis, it can explain that it could be something new that I have to add to the list that of stuff that can cause high LDH. But I'm really curious where the real
No, man,
Sanjay Patel, when he's this guy is younger, but he's way wiser.
I think Dr. Patel has this. I think that what's happened to me authentically is I now have like tossed out what everybody has, all the chart lore that you said, it's in the trash for me because has she really lost weight? I don't know. I haven't proven that to myself yet. Is she really having fevers? I haven't proven that to myself yet. So I don't really know what the problem is. And so I think what do I see in front of me? I see somebody who's not really suffering that much. Who has not cachectic and potentially eating a full breakfast. The joint stuff is so nonspecific that's hard to it's hard to take that to the bank. And I'll share a rule with everybody. There is no disease that lives in the extremities that causes weight loss. In order for a disease to cause weight loss, it has to affect your viscera. Cannot,
Interesting.
cannot, you can't have melanoma cause weight loss without going to the chest. You can't have rheumatoid arthritis cause weight loss without affecting your lungs, your esophagus. So if you found a clue on the extremity, it shouldn't really consume you. So what am I thinking? I think a TSH will never miss hyperthyroidism again.
We'll never miss it.
That's
So I do
true.
a good thyroid exam.
TSH was normal, but good
Oh,
one. Good
yeah.
one.
And I had
And we actually kept her OBS as well. So we kept her a night, actually the night before I met her, and she did have like documented fevers for about
And
30
how do you remember
days.
how high it was?
I don't, but it was like my guess is like, north of 39.
Yeah, and I think if she has a fever, the only thing that I would it would be really key is to sort of see her while she's febrile, because
I didn't get to do that.
I think that yeah. Otherwise, I'm stumped. I don't think I have any.
No, I think you guys are closer than you think. It's a key piece of history, and it's something that you have to ask about. So Reza, you actually, one of you guys, or I'll say Reza, actually had the diagnosis. But you have to think about the question because it's something that she 4 months in, she no longer had, but had at some point in her illness.
We're not going to ever make $100,000 per patient unless we get this
Oh
diagnosis.
my God.
Our life is doomed to just RLRCP
Think
solvers.
so.
But you know what? I love our community so much. I
Reza,
didn't
when
want
you
to.
talked about the ferritin and how it's a pretty short differential, right?
So we talked about Robbie HLH. There's nothing we can ask for that. We talked about adult onset Still's disease, but we know that's the Yamaguchi criteria. And I know your partner is listening to me very carefully. I have to use my words very carefully here, this budding rheumatologist. We talked about histo, which you can't really do anything. And then
I
Oh, go
think I know what
ahead.
it's getting at. No, I think
Go for it.
no. I think you're. I think the only thing that would make sense is she's like so well. I'm curious if Dr. Patel asked her, "Hey, did you ever have a sore throat when this started?" As a beginning of still, that would be my guess. But I'm curious how you jump with that.
You got so silent.
I did. You got confident. I got very serious, but I got very serious. But I'm very intrigued by like the idea. You know, like where I'm at is like the fever is the fever is the fire alarm gone wrong, rather than like
Right.
consuming. And you have hepatocellular injury. You have
Yes.
high ferritin,
Right.
the high
Well,
LDH
and the white count was up at
was
some
high.
point.
It was up at some
So
point.
I would probably be curious if she had a
So
sore
yeah,
throat. Oh, and a
so
salmon colored rash
and
or
a salmon
something.
colored rash. Yeah, to which she says, "I didn't have a sore throat when it started, but I did have this funny looking rash."
Wow.
That's cool.
And ultimately, I would tell Dr. Sanjay Patel to confirm the diagnosis. Did you give, is it anakinra they give? What do they give for adult onset stills? Is it like an Jack?
They give Jack.
No,
Jack?
so at this
Yeah.
point, let me tell you the true story of what happened. I
That's
was just a med student doing clinical skills. You remember this, right? So we're learning clinical skills,
Yeah.
and you know they always pick the nicest patient in the hospital. And this poor girl, she'd gone through so much, she volunteered.
Wow.
So here we are, me and a
Oh.
couple of my classmates, and we go in, and you know we're asking all of our questions, and we're like awkwardly hitting her with a reflex hammer. And in bounds this retired ID doctor.
Oh.
Like he literally was retired. So he walks right in, and he's also old school. So he's like not the nicest doctor. He like brushes all of us off, immediately just starts examining her, like feeling her joints and everything, and asking questions. And he's the one that asks, when this started, did you have a rash? And where was it? So she had a rash on her trunk. It was like salmon colored. She's Caucasian, so it
Three.
was like a salmon colored rash on her trunk. It was like slightly itchy. And then this is the part that really blew my mind. I'm sitting here like, what is happening right now? Right? Because I'm just a med student. She's seen 100 doctors. Nobody knows what's going on. This retired doctor comes in and seems to be figuring it out. And he goes, "I know exactly what you have, and you'll be better in a few weeks." And he like storms out of the room. And on his chart, he writes the treatment. High dose ibuprofen.
Yeah, crazy.
Yeah. So the treatment, so a lot of times people get, naprosyn, sometimes prednisone, but in her case, she got high dose ibuprofen, and within a few weeks, fevers were
That's amazing.
completely
That's pretty
gone, and
cool.
she went back to
You
serving.
know, like something that I think I'm going to take away from this case is that when you have a syndrome that's going on for 4 months, there's so much that can happen in terms of missing one of the, classic symptoms or things that we do to add more stuff to it, which doesn't represent the initial clinical
Yes.
syndrome.
Yes.
Yeah. This
That's
is
right.
so, like, it just tells you, I guess, the longer the diagnosis goes evaded, the more difficult because of the muddiness that
Yes.
we do or the symptoms that we forget from the beginning.
And
I want to
that's
retire
exactly
now.
why I love this case and why, because it is sort of that old school, just go straight back to the history.
Dude, and
And
then
I
you see
think,
like
like
Quetodian
when she was
fever.
on base and had this rash and a fever, right? They're like, "Oh, this is a febrile rash," or "She's hot," or "It's part of this infectious syndrome." And then, but once she left and people weren't thinking about that anymore, right? She just was a bunch of lab values.
You know what's crazy too is like with all that negative testing, right? All of a sudden, the unlikely becomes the most likely. Like you tell anyone, AST, ALT, leukocytosis, rash, fever, joint pain. How could it be anything other than, and a CT that's negative?
100%.
Anything other than, that's really
You guys
cool.
nailed it, man. I mean, that was
That is so cool.
impressive.
It,
Impressive.
it's so illustrative of how you need the, you can't diagnose a rationalopenic Still's disease. It's like such a fundamental part of the diagnosis that like vast majority of people have a rash. And so it's amazing how this doc like thought of it, but didn't take the absence of a rash in the moment as an argument against it, but thought to go
Yes.
like, let me go back in time. That's
And it
like,
is classic when you read about it. It's a transient, right?
yes.
But the thing is, most people present during the rash, right? Like,
Yes.
and people's, diagnose it during that period. But for her, it's a transient rash, but she, I don't think that many patients present that many months
Yeah.
out,
And she
right?
got
So
better,
she's,
like the high dose, it worked for her. like
It did.
symptoms. Wow.
Symptoms completely
How crazy
resolved.
is that? You can be like, hey, you're 4 months of undiagnosed disease. I can cure
Ibuprofen.
with $1
Oh
ibuprofen.
my God.
No, and that's what inspired me to, you know, I'm nothing like the both of you. I'm not at that level, but to focus a lot on my on diagnosis, because you know, I was just to me that the fact that somebody somewhere knew what to do with this patient, right? And yet hundreds of doctors, I mean tens of thousands of dollars worth of exams, and somebody with purely their mind and hands
It's
were
amazing.
able to nail this diagnosis. Like for me, at that formative stage, like literally I'm learning clinical skills. I'm like, I want to be that guy, but
That's
nicer.
really cool. Really.
You know, and I think, and it goes back to the doctors as heroes. I mean, can you imagine for that woman, you know, she went back to serving in the Marines and, you know, she's thinking
That's
like, you
amazing.
know, this guy purely with his mind.
Sean, two final comments, and then we'll let you close it out. One is, where can people, when and where can they pick up the book, and in what formats?
Thanks for asking. So yeah, the book's out with a I was really lucky to get a great publisher, so it's going to be everywhere. It's not coming out till February 24th, but you can get it now. And I actually really push for it to come out on all formats at the same time. So it's going to be
Amazing.
hardcover, paperback. We have a great audio recording. It's going to be on Kindle. All of it's coming up right from the jump.
I want to just really encourage anyone who listens to this to just go pre-order it. Let's make this thing as big as possible. Trust me, it's really, really good, and the author deserves it. But then secondly, I know that there may be a movie. Like, they already bought the, am I allowed to say that or not?
Yeah,
Oh,
no, you
because then
again,
I was
we
going to comment, if you need two people on set,
Yes,
more
there
than
we
one,
go.
please recommend us to, we
I
will
would
fly
love
out.
absolutely. No, it's been yeah, we were lucky enough to sell the rights
That's
and to the move
amazing.
to film, and it's been an incredible journey. Actually, I'll end with this. You mentioned House of God. At one point in the journey when I was like very low, I actually sent a copy of the novel at the time to Samuel Shem, who that's his pen name, but to the author that wrote House of God. And a couple days later, I get a phone call from a
Whoa.
617 number. So I pick it up. I always think it's a patient of mine. And he's like, "Is this, you know, Shantana Rai?" And I was like, "Yeah, you know." And he's like, "This is Samuel Shem, AKA Steve Bergman." And I was like, "Oh my God, sir, hello." You know. And he's like, "I got your book. And do you know how many books I get? All these books from med students and residents and all this drivel." And I'm like, "Oh no, like you don't have to read it. It's okay. It's okay. Like, just throw it away. I'm so sorry I bothered you." And he's like, "I read it and this book has to get published."
Oh man, that's huge.
And he helped me out at a low point. Actually ended up connecting me to his editor that he wrote all of his books with, who was amazing. And you know, he was inspiring. You know, House of God was like a Bible for so many of us, right, through training. But also, not everyone knows this, House of God actually is partially attributed with changing residency work hours. Because it got the public, because it's all about residency, it got public, the general public to understand kind of how inhumane, you know, residency is. And so going back, and maybe I'll end with this note, it's like, that's why I wrote it. I wrote it because I want doctors to be entertained. I hope they see themselves, the best versions of themselves in the book. And I hope that if enough people read it and really see kind of how badly the system, you know, treats doctors and marginalizes us, that maybe you'll get people to care. And then if they care, maybe they'll fight for change.
That's so beautiful. Well, I can guarantee you that no one who subscribes to this is a fan of us too, but I think at the end of this journey they'll be big fans of your work. This is so cool. Hey, kudos on such a moving and powerful piece of work that I think will change many people's lives.
Thank you. Thank you both.
Do-do-do.
That's a wrap, folks.
Woo!